Welcome to today's Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior Journal Club webinar, the first in a series of 10 webinars focused on research methods. As the official peer-reviewed journal of the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior, JNEB serves to advance nutrition education and behavior related research, practice, and policy. The Spring Journal Club series was organized with the assistance of the SNEB Research Division, so a big thank you to them. Before we begin, I'd like to review a few pieces of information for you. If you look in the GoToWebinar toolbar on the side of your screen, you'll see a section called Handouts. Here you will find the slide for today's presentation. Feel free to download the slides and take notes as you follow along. We will take questions at the end of the presentation. Throughout the presentation, please type any questions you may have into the questions box, and they will be moderated out to our panelists. When the webinar ends today, you will be prompted to complete a short survey. Please take a moment to complete this, as your feedback is greatly appreciated for future SNEB webinars. This webinar is being recorded and will be available free of charge to SNEB members under the webinar section of the website. And finally, watch for a follow-up email to be sent in the next few days that will include a link to the recording for this session, the slide handouts, and your CEU certificate for attendance today. I can now hand things over to our moderator, Dr. Kristen DeFilippo, teaching assistant professor at the University of Illinois. Kristen?
Thank you so much. Today I get to introduce our speakers. Reagan Burney has been working in the field of childhood obesity prevention, managing multiple research projects for 7 years. However, their PhD is in human development and family studies, specifically focused on co-parenting and child development and temperament. Reagan has really enjoyed diving into the world of nutrition and physical activity, especially as a parent of two girls. Derek Hales is research faculty at UNC Chapel Hill. His training and expertise are in measuring physical activity and the environment, social, and personal factors that relate to physical activity behavior. I want to thank both of them for joining us today and sharing their work with us. At this point, I can pass it over to our presenters.
Great. Thank you, Kristen. Thanks so much for having us, everyone. Derek and I are very excited to talk to you all about our paper, Self-Efficacy for Healthy Eating Moderates the Impact of Stress on Diet Quality Among Family Child Care Home Providers. Just a quick note of the educator competencies that we'll just go over today that will apply to today's discussion during the webinar. And then we just wanted to start off with a few disclosures. Philip Dobson, who's actually the first author of this paper, started off as a junior with our research team, and as a part of his experience with us, chose to write an honors thesis. So parts of this paper are influenced by his interests, as well as the experience of doing a thesis for the first time as an undergraduate student, and then once graduating, turning that into a published manuscript. I also just want to point out that our main project this paper comes from was a National Institutes of Health funded project from 2012 to 2017, as well as a registered clinical trial. So, as I mentioned, Philip came his junior year, and when you come your junior year, you're learning about how research is done, just getting your feet wet, doing some hands-on tasks, reading about research, learning about your research interests, and how you can make these interests further. So Philip is really interested in the adults who care for children and the experiences they go through and how those experiences affect them. And specifically, as a nutrition major, he was interested in what affects the healthy choices they make. So this paper today really examines the relationships between stress, sleep quality, diet self-efficacy, which we define as confidence in adapting behaviors and dissolving barriers around consuming healthy foods, as well as diet quality. And our major question today that we're going to look at is, does diet self-efficacy moderate the impact of sleep quality and stress on diet quality? So before we jump into too much of the measures, we did want to give it just a little bit of a background about who we're studying and kind of where this paper came from. So Philip is learning about his interests, and like I said, very interested in adults who care for children. And we had this large project called the KEYS Project that focused on family child care home providers. And family type child care home providers is a lot of work, so I'm going to just call them FCCH providers from now on. And so FCCH providers are those who care for children in their own home. They often run the business by themselves, possibly with some help from their family members. So they are a provider to the children, their cook, their administrator, all rolled into one. They often care for children in a range of ages and diverse economic backgrounds in small clusters. So they have, you know, anywhere from little infants to after school kids all in the same house at the same time. They have these unique characteristics that make them different from Head Starts or other childcare centers. We found that they fiercely want what's best for the children in their care. And in order to do the best, so they often end up with a lot on their plate at once. So again, Philip is really interested in the things that affect how they interact with the children in their care. And as you can imagine, these providers tend to have higher rates of stress and sleep problems, given all that's on their plate. In addition, early educators, including FCCH providers, are more likely to have obesity. The overall prevalence of obesity in women is 40%, and in early educator providers is estimated at 66%. With higher stress and sleep problems, among other challenges, these FCCH providers are more likely to engage in sedentary activities and have poorer diet quality. So that was kind of focusing on all the negative pieces. And Philip also was interested in what might be a protective factor for these providers, as they often can't take those things off their plates. And so as he was learning and reading all of this during that first year, he came across social cognitive theory, which proposes that those who are more confident in their ability to overcome obstacles are just more likely to cope with stressors and adopt beneficial health behaviors. So those who are confident about their knowledge and abilities to make healthy choices are obviously just more likely to do so, even when there are barriers like stress and sleep problems. So as I mentioned earlier, we had a large NIH-funded project called KEYS. It was a two-arm randomized control trial, which was evaluating the efficacy of a 9-month obesity prevention intervention. And there were three tenets that the intervention was comprised of. So this first one is the heart tenet, and that was the healthy you, which focused it on provider health with the hope that they, of course, improve their own health and also be healthier models for the children in their care. And with that, we also were interested in healthy home, which was the primary target for the project, which focused on improving the health for the children. So the health of the environment the FCCH had, what the FCCH provider was providing to the children, how they interacted with children, and their policies and professional development all around nutrition and physical activity. And then the final one was healthy business, because of course, not only are they the providers, they're also all these administrators. And so trying to help them improve their business side of things as well. So changes in child nutrition and physical activity were the primary outcomes for this project. Although important, the changes in provider health were secondary, and this will come into play when we deep dive into the discussion of the measures that were chosen and why. So now we'll start deep diving into some of the methods. And a big part of methods is recruitment, because, well, without the people, there's nothing to study. So the KEYS project recruited 166 FCCH providers over 5 waves of data collection over 2.5 years across Central North Carolina. We had a lot of lessons learned as we tried to recruit from this population. And while our first wave of data collection was pretty successful, it was the closest to the university, a little bit more in urban areas, and in places where we're a little more well-known. We noticed a drop in recruitment in wave two and realized pretty early on that if we were going to reach our milestone goals, we had to change tactics. So I'm going to go through briefly what we originally thought would work, how we revised those steps, and then in the next slide, I'm going to go over some of our deep dive into our lessons learned. So FCCH providers are just not as used to research studies as Head Starts and centers are. So having people in their house that are outside of the families, it's just not, doesn't happen to them for them very often, and they're a little more wary of research. So the original recruitment plan, we did think to informally communicate with our local community partners before starting the project. So this was really just some simple emails that we sent, just saying, hey, we're doing this project in your area, we just wanted you to know, here's kind of what it comprises of. When we revised our recruitment, we noticed that we had to build in more buy-in from these folks who already work with family child care homes, and as well as get their support because of this wariness that we started to find. What we found was that we started reaching out to CSCFP sponsors, child care resource and referrals, in each county or region's partnership for children. And these are the people who often work directly with family child care homes. We got their input on how best to approach what they've done with FACH providers, figure out what would appeal to them, as well as get their support. And it varied by county, and it varied whether it was rural versus urban. I had one partnership for children who called every single one of their FCCHs, told them about the program, and let us know kind of an interest level of each of them, which was great. We also decided to go to in-person trainings that were already going on where FCCH providers were. Just took a few minutes at the training to go over the project, give them some resources, so that way when we did the calls later, they would have heard of us. And we found that those things really helped, really to get that the people that they already trust to provide support and encouragement. We found that that really helped a lot. So after communicating with community partners, the next step was to email and mail invitations to FCCH providers. And we had, North Carolina has a public database that we could use, and we were able to use that and get email if they had it, as well as mail those invitations. So while people did appreciate that, we found that our materials needed to be a little more visual. We needed to highlight things better and remove jargon. So what we did was when we did that, we decided to put things in a more visual picture way. So instead of having a bunch of words, we put pictures in there. We removed as much research jargon without telling them what they needed to know. And we highlighted parts. Another thing that we did when we mailed these invitations is that by the time we were doing wave three, wave one had already started the program, and we got testimonials from people in wave one, kind of, again, just reiterating what would be the benefits of being a part of this project and how they were feeling about doing the intervention. And that really helped a lot. Some people knew some of the people already, so that was really great. And then just, again, hearing people who are already doing what you do, being excited about a project really helped a lot. So of course, after you do that, we would also call and screen FCCH providers. So in our revise, we still were calling and screening them, but we decided to revise our screening script and train our data collectors a little bit more in a slightly different way. So we started to put more of the benefits early on in the call to really hook our providers, as they don't have a lot of time on the phone, but we also wanted them to know what was going on. So we tried to hook them earlier on, and again, try to make sure they knew the steps. So at the very end, we kind of went over, we asked them like, here are some questions. Did you understand everything you were told today? And they were very specific to what was going to happen to data collection. What would they do during the intervention? That way we can make sure that people really understood what we were trying to tell them. So those were some of the changes we made there. So after calling and screening and someone saying, oh, sure, you can, I'm interested, we would mail them welcome packets. And another piece and part of this project was recruiting parents, because we were measuring 1.5 to 4-year-olds, and we had to have at least 3 children in the home meet that age group, and they would have to consent to be a part of the project. So in this one, we mailed everything to them in one big packet, whereas in the revise, we decided it'd be better to drop off the packets in person and review project details. The other thing that we did here is, A, this was a touch point. These are people who don't get to talk to a lot of adults, so they really appreciated that part, as well as really go over everything again. We brought a timeline that we went over with them. We brought tangible items that they might receive if they were in the intervention. We brought a binder of what they would learn if they were in the intervention. As well, we brought a recruitment poster they could put up in their house for parents, and we brought them some talking points if they wanted to talk to their parents about it as well before we did. So they really appreciated being able to review the project, review everything. I think it made them less wary about research, and also just, you know, get that little face-to-face contact, which I think really helped build rapport. So again, in the original recruitment, we mailed everything, and then we followed up by phone and had them mail back everything back to us. But we found that that was hard, and it took a lot of time. So what we did was we decided to pick up forms in person and help with parent recruitment, meaning, and again, another touch point with this provider, building that trust, building that rapport with them, and also as well, lightening their load. Again, providers have a lot on their plate, so we decided to come when most of the kids get picked up so we could intercept parents and they could ask us questions. We can get the consent form right there for them. We also did make sure we asked providers whether or not they would be okay with that, because we did find that in some places, providers were like, ooh, I don't know if I really want my parents to know, you know, I don't really want my parents to have you come in and do this because they might be wary of it. It'd be better if it came from me. So for some people, we did this, and for some people, we didn't. But we just, again, we're trying to lighten their load. And that was the whole point of that. And then the final step of recruitment was, once we received everything from the providers, we went ahead and scheduled their baseline visits. And a baseline visit was a two-day home visit that we went into. So it was like a Monday, Wednesday, or Thursday, Tuesday, Thursday. And whereas in the revised, when we picked up everything from the consents and we had everything we did, we went ahead and just scheduled the baseline visit right then and there. Because as you can imagine, mailing everything back, getting these people on the phone yet again, could lose momentum. So we found that this really helped get people excited and stay excited. So just to kind of recap lessons learned, the importance of investing time with partners who the FCCHS trusts, so people that support and encourage your project would be really helpful. And again, you have to make the case that it's going to be beneficial to your population. Building rapport, so all those touch points. People really like that face-to-face, and the providers really appreciated that because they didn't do a lot of email. That wasn't a way that they communicated either with their families or with other people, but they really appreciated those touch points. They also really appreciated the tangible items. I think it got people really excited to see the binders, to see the items they would get, and to look over the timeline together. The other thing is to address, you know, valid concerns about research. These people who are, you know, wary of having people, the only people who tend to come to their homes are people who are judging them or rating them for quality purposes. So to have other people come in, they are a little wary of having you, that they think you might judge them, even though you're not, because you're just doing research, but that's kind of the intention they have. So kind of breaking down that barrier and those touch points allow us to do that, as well as clarify everything they did. In wave one, we found that some providers were caught off guard by what they had to do once the intervention started, and we did not want that to happen. So that's just not, doesn't keep people interested in participating when they feel that way. So we want to make sure that they knew everything they were going to be involved in. And just being aware of those relationships with their parents and families, as I mentioned during the, whether or not you would do those parent interceptions or not. But again, anything that you can do to lighten their load is really important, as they have so much on their plate. And then just the importance of keeping the momentum going. Because once you get people interested, you gotta keep going or else they kind of fall off. And we had really great participation from the time people did the baseline measures through the intervention, through follow-up. Everyone participated at follow-up, and I think we had like 95% participation at intervention. So I think these lessons learned, recruitment lessons, really helped keep everything moving. Okay, and next I want to talk a little bit about the demographics. So who was in our study? We had 100% female family child home providers, 74% of them were African-American, 78% were making incomes under $50,000. We had a wide variety of education, but again, about a quarter of them had a high school diploma and about a quarter of them had a four-year college degree, and they're about 49 years old. And this matches very well with the North Carolina Child Care Workforce Study Report on the demographics of the FCCH providers in 2014. And in that workforce report, 99% of FCCH providers were women. The average age was 51 years old. 67% were people of color, and 74% had an annual income below $50,000. So again, a well-represented sample for FCCH providers in North Carolina. All right, and now, during the two-day home visits I talked about, during one of them, we measured providers during that time, and we trained data collectors using protocol in the NHANES 3 anthropometry procedures manual. They used a shortboard to measure height to the nearest eighth inch and a Senka Model 874 portable electronic scale to measure weight to the nearest 0.1 pound. All measures were taken at least twice, and if the first two were within an accessible range, they were averaged. If not, a third was taken and the two closest were averaged. BMI was calculated using height and weight, and a large percentage of our FCCH providers were measured to have overweight or obesity, and our 64.5% obese is similar among national levels, reporting the 66 percent for early childhood education providers overall that I reported earlier. All right. And now I'm going to hand it over to Derek.
Very good. So now I'm going to take us through our measurement methods and then a little bit about, so the measurement of our three primary predictors and our main outcomes, and walking through the analysis and the results section. And, you know, when I think about measures and methods, I always like to try to think about them in the context of the larger project. Measure selection is generally goes well beyond the specific purpose of a paper. And, you know, there's like a lot of things that go into it, especially thinking about the quality of measure, the importance of the measure within the overall project, and then the burden of the measure on the participant and on study resources, and trying to find the best measures that, you know, fit the outcomes that you're looking for. And, you know, for the KEYS project, you know, since child level information is part of the primary aims of the study, we knew that the providers mostly were going to be reporting with self-report. And so that kind of, you know, leads you in a certain direction in terms of selecting measures. And so we had, for this, the purpose of this project, we measured three kind of primary predictors. We're looking at perceived stress, sleep problems, and diet self-efficacy. And the first of those, what we measured with the perceived stress scale, which is a really common scale. It's been around for a while, where it has people with basically 10 items rate the frequency of issues with coping or control or stressful thoughts or feelings in the past month. For our sample, we had pretty good, we had really good internal consistency for the 10 items within that scale. And for each of these scales, I kind of showed the relationship to the other things that we measured in just simple correlations. And then the average score and kind of the distribution, the range of those scores. So for stress, we had some good variability in the range of scores. Perceived stress, where a higher score indicates more stress, was positively correlated with sleep problems, negatively related with diet self-efficacy, and had negative relationship with, but really small relationship with the modified HEI. Let me see if I can, you advance me one? I don't know if I can. There we go. Is that right? Okay. So providers also completed the medical outcome study sleep scale, which is actually 12 full items. But for the purpose of this project, we took the 9 items that are part of the sleep project, the sleep problems index, which basically asks about sleep disturbance, problem sleeping, tiredness during the day on this 1 to 6 scale. For those 9 items, that scale is then converted to a 0 to 100 scale, and those items are averaged, almost like you're looking at a percent of time that you have sleep problems. It's kind of it's not specifically interpreted that way, but it's kind of presented that way. It, again, in good internal consistency with the sleep problem scale. The variability was pretty good in our sample. It was only seemed to be related to perceived stress. So again, higher sleep problems were positively related to reports of higher stress levels, negative, but really small, not really significant correlations with diet self-efficacy and modified HEI. The next thing the providers did was complete 5 existing scales that measure diet self-efficacy. And diet self-efficacy for the provider was a little bit higher up on our scale of importance for the overall project. And so we decided to pick a number of measures of kind of separate components that might play into their overall diet self-efficacy, where 3 of those components were kind of focused on more specific food categories like unhealthy foods or fruit and vegetables and dietary fiber. Or whole wheat foods. And then 2 of those scales were focused on the confidence and the ability to make a plan of action or to overcome barriers related to diet or consuming healthy foods. And so those 5 scales were combined into 1 overall estimate of diet self-efficacy for this project. Overall, We had all those scales that had good internal consistency. Two reasons that we decided to combine them into one scale. One being, you know, Reagan mentioned before, this was started as a student project. And, you know, one of the goals was that we start with a question and we move through the process of answering that question and not end up with an overly complex model that's kind of hard to interpret in the end. And the other thing that, you know, while we didn't do a, you know, a strict exploratory factor analysis or run confirmatory models, we found that those five scales were pretty highly related. They're moderate to highly related in terms of correlations with each other. And other people have combined those scales or similar scales to get overall measures of diet self-efficacy. So we thought it was reasonable to combine them into one estimate, 18.6 average on a basically 5 to 25 scale, some good variability. Diet self-efficacy was negatively related to stress. So the higher the stress, the lower the diet self-efficacy generally, and it was positively, so diet self-efficacy was positively related to our modified HEI, which is our diet quality score in our sample of providers. The last measure that I'm going to talk about is our estimate of ultimately we're trying to get to an estimate of diet quality. And in the larger, I like to put this in context. So in the larger project, child level diet quality was you know, one of the primary outcomes. And for children, we were going to do direct observation in the center where we observed food served and foods consumed. That data was all entered into NDSR. And we, from that output, we estimated HEI or diet quality scores for the children. And the hope was that given the limitations of what we knew we could get from providers, we also wanted to get a similar estimate of diet quality for the providers, and which led us into one, wanting to be able to capture all the components that might go into an HEI, but also considering that we didn't have the feasibility to do multiple 24-hour recalls or something more detailed, and which led us to this brief block food frequency questionnaire, which is a measure that includes multiple, 72 common foods where they're reporting on the amount of that food and how often they eat that food. And the amounts are kind of, depending on the type of the food it is, whether it's the number of that food or it's based on this portion scale, how much of it looks on a plate, in a plate or a bowl. And it also has a standardized method to estimate some common outcomes that would be beneficial for looking at diet quality. So ultimately, we want to get to a measure of diet quality, and we're basing our measure of diet quality on the Healthy Eating Index. And I know that most people in here are probably familiar somewhat, but the HEI is made up of these 12 dietary components. There's a set of adequacy components and a set of moderation components. And each of those individual components is scored based on the amount that someone eats from 0 to 5 or zero on a 0 to 10 scale. Scores on each of those components are then combined and added up into an overall HEI score, which is an indicator of diet quality. Basically goes from 0 to 100. The higher the score, the better your diet quality. Generally, the HEI is tagged with, there's a 2010, a 2015 of the kind of the year that the scoring was modified or developed. When this was developed and kind of processed, we were still using the HEI 2010 criteria for setting up our diet quality. So, how do we get from the FFQ that the provider completed to our estimate of diet quality, which is based on the components that are and the way the HEI is computed? So I kind of broke down, it's kind of a, I have a simplified version of the process, and my hat is off. I was actually only kind of peripherally involved in actually laying out all of the detailed processes and considerations that needed to happen to take the FFQ and turn it into this diet quality. So everybody on our team that put the time and effort into that, they did a nice job of kind of setting up a very clear and standardized way to move from one to the other. And the process is basically, on the one end, you're starting with taking the foods and outcomes that you have in the FFQ and mapping those onto those 12 components from the HEI score. And within each of those components, you're estimating amounts per day. So I give two examples, one being the total fruit component and one being the dairy component. So within the FFQ, we can take the fruits that are listed and the times per day and the cups that are that the participant filled out, and we can get an estimate of cup equivalents, or for some components it's gram equivalents or ounce equivalents per day for the foods that they're eating. The other example I gave was the dairy, and dairy actually has an outcome from the FFQ. This is one of the benefits of using this FFQ, is that there's certain components, dairy and certain fats, that take the foods that are reported and then automatically give you estimates of these individual components, which can be important in matching up with those HEI or diet quality components. So in the dairy, you don't actually have to take each individual food. There's an automated variable that is kind of cups of dairy per day. So, as we shift to the right in there, in this kind of breakdown of the process, the next thing we do is we adjust for total calories. So the HEI is kind of put on the standardized per 1,000 calorie scale. And one of the benefits of this FFQ is we get a rough estimate of total kcals per day. So we can take our cups or grams or ounces and we can adjust those for total calories and get our per 1,000 calorie estimate. And then we can shift over to the right a little bit more as we get closer to our HEI score. And we can take, for each of the HEI components, there is kind of a standard goal value. So for fruits, the goal is 0.8 cups per 1,000 calories, and for dairy, it's 1.3 cups. Basically, if someone gets to that score, they're meeting the standard and they get scored the highest score for that component. So for fruits, total fruits, it's scored from 0 to 5, and for dairy, it's scored from 0 to 10. So basically, we can take our cup equivalents per 1,000 calories and see how closely someone gets to the standard of 0.8 cups. So if someone had 0.4 cups, they're halfway there. So on a scale from 0 to 5, they'd score a 2.5. If someone had one cup, they're actually exceeding the standard, so they'd get the max score of 5. So that's the kind of the process that we used from taking FFQ data, mapping it, and then using this HEI scoring procedure to get a modified HEI 2010 score for each of our providers. So once we get each of those 12 component scores, we would add them up, and we estimated, or we got an average of 59.4. We had good variability in our HEI score, and a fairly good range in terms of from very low to pretty high diet quality in our sample. The other thing that we did to make sure that it seemed about right, our 59.4, was to actually look at NHANES data from around the time the data was collected, which was basically 2009 to 2012, and see how that compared with HEI scores for all Americans that were computed with the NHANES data. And so at the bottom there, I have 57.3 and 58.3, so around 58 for all Americans, that's including men and women. The other thing that is noted in the NHANES data is that women tend to score slightly higher for HEI score. So our score around 59, it's a little bit higher than for all Americans, but it's probably actually pretty close to the average for adult women in our age range. So our modified HEI diet quality score, small negative correlations with stress and sleep, as we've seen before, and positive correlation with diet self-efficacy. So those are all our primary measures. So we had our three predictors, which were stress, sleep problems and diet self-efficacy in our primary outcome, which was diet quality, this modified HVI score. And now we're going to shift into talking a little bit about the analyses and the results of the study. And I kind of put these in the framework that, again, how Reagan talked about this was started as a student project. It was kind of a learning project. And so part of designing and thinking about the analyses were setting it up and you know, having sound methods, but that could be progressed through in this step-by-step manner that led us to understanding the data better and also answering our question in the end. So, you know, ultimately we started with simple correlations among measures, looking at distributions of measures and making sure they, you know, met assumptions of statistical models. And then we moved into looking at this kind of step-by-step progression of regression models from very simple models to a more complex model to get at the answers to the questions that we had for the project. So we started out with our single predictor models, which are basically each of the individual predictors included in a model with the covariates. And for this project, we use BMI as a continuous measure as a covariate, and we use income as a three-level indicator. And you know, for this project, we had just simple indicators and covariates. You know, from the single indicator models, again, very similar to the correlations. Diet self-efficacy was the only significant predictor of HEI or diet quality. The next step was to shift to a slightly more complex model where we combined all three predictors into a single model that included the covariates and looked at its relationship to diet quality. Overall, all three of these predictors together had a, you know, the adjusted R-square was not huge, it's around 0.08. Again, diet self-efficacy was the only thing significant. One thing that we did note as we shifted into this more complex model is that while stress is not a significant predictor, in shifting from the single predictor models to the more complex models, it was the only predictor actually that had a bigger shift in its beta value, which can indicate that maybe there's something else going on with stress. We saw before that sleep and stress are correlated, so there's something potentially going on there. And then our next step in this process was the full interaction model. So having our three primary indicators, but then also including the interaction or the moderation effect potentially of diet self-efficacy with stress and diet self-efficacy with sleep. So in this full model, again, we had diet self-efficacy and stress, the interaction as a significant interaction effect in the model. And we actually saw a substantial increase while still relatively small in the adjusted R-square, so the prediction of diet quality in this model. My personal opinion is that whenever we're looking at interaction models or moderation effects, that if at all possible in our papers or when we're talking to groups, that we should try to show these effects in some sort of visual way. I think it's a better explanation. It's a better way to explain. It's easier to see what the interaction actually means. And from these, basically what we're doing is taking from the final model with the primary effects and the interaction effects, we're taking that model and we're looking at diet quality across levels of stress here along the bottom, the X, and levels of diet self-efficacy, which each of these lines represents a different level of diet self-efficacy. So if we start on the left-hand side, the lowest stress level, which is plotted as one standard deviation below the mean for stress, for average stress, you see that in that, at that level of stress, it doesn't necessarily matter what diet self-efficacy is in terms of diet quality. So everybody, everybody in the low stress group, it doesn't necessarily matter what their diet quality is. They have a very similar diet quality score. There's some slight differences in lows and highs, but it's a pretty small difference. What happens though is as stress levels increase, if your diet self-efficacy is low, your diet quality tends to go down. So at the highest stress level, your diet your diet quality is gone down quite a bit. However, if you have higher or even average levels of diet self-efficacy, as stress increased, you either basically maintain your diet quality, or, you know, in the case of having higher diet self-efficacy, there's actually some protective effects. So potentially, as stress is a little bit higher, diet quality actually increases in those with higher diet self-efficacy. So, you know, one thing that I, you know, and I'll apologize. One thing I didn't mention early on was that, you know, all of our, and this is part of our, you know, some of the discussion is that all of the data are cross-sectional, and I know that sometimes I may have slipped into causal language when talking about the analysis and the results, but officially everything is kind of cross-sectional, and, you know, that was a general summary of kind of our measures and the results, and now we're going to wrap up with a discussion of things we learned and from the project.
So just some take-home points. So just a reminder that the unique challenges that FCCH providers face, you know, all those sort of roles rolled into one, a little bit more stress, a little more sleep problems, higher rates of obesity, really just making them an important population for future interventions. And the studies show that even when there are challenges for these providers like stress, those who feel confident in their abilities to make healthy choices are more likely to do so, probably make a plan, maintain that healthy diet despite the stress. So instead of eating that candy bar like I might, they make a plan and overcome that barrier and eat a sweet piece of pineapple instead. And this relates back to social cognitive theory, which suggests that some individuals respond to stress with actual coping behaviors, which is why we're which could possibly explain that, you know, higher take in healthy diet quality with the stress than without the stress. So it kind of makes you more like more aware that you need to cope and make changes rather than anxiety, which might be the opposite side, is why some of them have less when they have the higher diet, worse diet quality when they have the lower, when they have the higher stress.
The other things that came out in the discussion is, you know, one of the things that we didn't find was that sleep, we found that sleep wasn't really related to much in the model. There's a number of, you know, we thought about a number of reasons that, you know, potentially it's more about the amount of sleep and not necessarily about someone's perception of sleep problems. It's maybe a more objective measure of quantity, or even a more objective measure of sleep quality or restlessness during the night. You know, the other potential thing with sleep is that, you know, all the relationship between sleep and diet quality is mediated by a stress. So we saw that sleep and stress were related, and stress and diet self-efficacy related. So potentially there's something there to be tested later on. We mentioned it's cross-sectional data, so we can't necessarily infer causality. Again, there's, you know, traditional biases with self-report, you know, potentially, you know, especially in some of the food data, although our food data tends to match up pretty well with, you know, the larger American, you know, the NHANES data that is a little bit more detailed in their processes of collecting the data, and also the amount and number of people that they measure. You know, there's some limitations in converting from FFQ to HEI. Not all of the components within the HEI had kind of perfect matches with the FFQ. I think whole grains needed to be the estimate of fiber that comes from the FFQ instead of a specific measure of whole grains. And there's plenty of other covariates that probably could be captured in other samples to try to look at differences across location, whether it's urban or rural, or food insecurity patterns, and how those might relate to this model as well.
And while there are limitations, there are also strengths to the study, and the results give us food for thought for future research. So one of our strengths is we realized early on that our recruitment had to change, and we were able to pivot. The major lesson was, of course, the importance of building trust and relationships with providers through various ways, and also making sure to understand and see things through their perspective, particularly as we try to encourage them to do things like research. Another strength of our study was that our sample was relatively representative of FCCH providers in North Carolina, which of course isn't representative of every FCCH provider, but something that doesn't always happen in research studies to have such a representative sample.
And you know, a couple of things that we identified as potential, you know, future applications or things that we might think about are, you know, we kind of really identified these two components that could be part of future interventions in terms of looking at changing diet quality in providers. This stress and diet self-efficacy and how they relate to each other could be explored in more detail, you know, which is easier to change, which is the best to change, or is there some sort of added effect of stress and diet self-efficacy? Is it easier to change one more quickly and one is a little bit more long-term and they kind of have a synchronous effect? And the other thing that we've talked about of potentially examining, looking at separating out those components of the HEI or diet self-efficacy or even potentially sleep or stress issues and seeing if any of those individual components relate to each other differently or are more or less important in this diet quality model.
And of course, we just want to acknowledge all our family took our home providers as well as our families who participated, as well as our team who put this paper together and got it out there. And a special call out to Shul Zosfi and Diane Ward, who are the principal investigators for the KEYS project, as well as our funding and all our fun, wonderful images and icons that made this hopefully a little more fun to watch.
And I guess now if there are questions or...
Yeah, thank you so much. Wrap up? It was great to hear about your project and to learn about the methods that you engaged in. So there are a couple questions. The first one from one of our listeners, did you encounter any regulatory issues for using only females in the research?
That's just who, we did not encounter any issues with that. It just happened to work out, it was not a requirement to be female to be in the project. So.
It wasn't a specification, like it wasn't a we're only going to record. It just happens that 98% of directors and workers are female in
So another question.
Inclusion criteria.
Yep. Makes sense. So this next question says, this is not exactly relevant to the current study, but how did you think the level of stress among the providers in the KEYS intervention arm had any effect on the intervention outcome? Do you think it is necessary to measure food insecurity and stress for providers themselves to measure impact of intervention?
I mean, I think that the stress diet quality relationship is probably an interesting one, and I think the external factors related to stress is something that we've actually talked about. In some of our newer projects, we're incorporating some resilience work into looking at relationship to healthy outcomes, and I think that some of that applies to looking at overall impact of stress that, you know, is definitely important in this model. I may have missed the first part of it. I don't know that the stress level of this population, of this group, is different than other providers when the data was collected. And I don't remember, we didn't have a lot of turnover, and I can't remember the numbers for turnover of childcare homes in terms of, you know, one of the one of the focuses of KEYS was that financial arm, which was something we found in some qualitative work to be an important factor, especially for childcare home. So it's a single person. And so the finances of their business was an important part. And so we thought that was an important part to go along with the children and the provider health in terms of promoting, you know, a quality business model.
Thank you. So another question, you talked about adopting recruitment strategies, and thank you so much for sharing that advice, because I know that's always a question of how do you recruit. Would you have any suggestions for adaptions in the current environment, considering restrictions researchers may face due to the pandemic?
Certainly much harder to get those in-persons as we've struggled with some of our own other projects that we have right now. So I think it is reaching out to those people who work with family child care home providers already, those community partners, probably leaning on them a little bit more than you might normally, because they're going to know the best way to access the providers. Because again, some of them might never read email, but they're like, oh, you could text them and they'll be better able to do that, or if you want to FaceTime them. So I think reaching out to your community partners who already work well with them would be a really big step that would help out. And then just again, I think it's just trying to reach them on whatever level that they're able to get you at. And it is, finding which way, what's their best way to communicate. And once you know that, kind of using that to your advantage. But again, trying to find ways to touch point them. So it could be that if they like the in-person, maybe trying to find if there's a way to Zoom or FaceTime them more often than like an email.
That makes sense. And then looking at the interaction between stress and self-efficacy and the Healthy Eating Index. So if you read it backwards, low stress and high self-efficacy seems to have a lower HEI than higher stress would. Can you talk about that? Why someone with high self-efficacy and low stress might not eat as well as someone who has high stress and high self-efficacy?
Okay. I mean, I think some of it with the high stress, sometimes stress kind of makes you more aware of what you're doing. So I can probably talk to that side. So again, people who have the higher stress but have that diet self-efficacy may be more likely to be like, oh, I need to make a plan because I'm stressed and I know that'll affect what I eat. Or I know how to overcome this barrier now. But I think it makes you more cognizant or more aware that you need to do something because you're stressed. Whereas if you don't have that stress, you may not really be thinking about it as much.
Yeah.
But I think it goes back to that social cognitive of like, they react with coping as opposed to not really thinking about it. So I think it's more just to be more influenced by the stress in a different, more beneficial way.
Yeah, that interaction was really interesting to see. I think that's all our questions we have. Thank you for answering them. And again, thank you for sharing your time and expertise with us. We really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you again for having us.
Thanks, it was great.
Thank you so much to our speakers and our moderator. We really appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us today. I have a few reminders before I close today's session. Please complete the survey you will receive when we close out. Your feedback is greatly appreciated. Be on the lookout for an email with today's recordings, handouts, and your CEU certificate. And if you enjoyed today's webinar, be sure to check out the upcoming webinars on the webinar section of the website. And just a few reminders, the deadline for conference abstracts is February 14th because SNUV loves research. And there are options to present in person in Atlanta as well as virtually this year. And we are taking a break from the Journal Club next Monday for a special USDA NIFA update. Please register to attend that session by visiting the SNUV website. So that concludes today's session. Thank you for joining us and have a great day.